Good morning.
Good morning.
Am I audible? Am I allowed to say audible, or is that trademarked?
The transcription is working.
I want to begin by acknowledging that we're on stolen Dakota land and on the severed Rondo neighborhood. And that we're practicing a practice that's been handed down through several continents and cultures. And this is, I think yesterday might have been the anniversary of when it was signed into, I don't know if it was an executive order or some legislation that the internment would begin of Japanese Americans. I know the bill, I've seen the bill. The bill that was posted in San Francisco is dated August 1st, but I think the actual law might have been February 19th.
Can you speak a little louder,
please? I'll try. I'm warming up. You know, I think it's a secret, but for most people, when you hear their bios, they wrote it themselves. It's a little trade secret. We write it in the third person, but we write it. And I was listening to my own. I'm like, oh Jesus, that's really ambitious. I was really thinking highly of myself that day. I was telling Minna in the car on the way here. I'm like, you know, I really think I'm smarter than I've ever been, and I also feel less confident than I've ever felt. And those feel very related. You know, when I started a Zen center when I was 30, and I used to roll in there and tell everybody what Buddhism was. It's really embarrassing. So I don't think I'm going to tell you what Buddhism is. I think yesterday I took a long walk. I live in Longfellow, near the Anne Sullivan School. And that's a landmark to me. I don't know if it's a landmark to you. And I walked all the way to the Trader Joe's near the stadium downtown. That's a fun landmark because that's where I get all of my $3 fake meat for the month. And I buy it all and then I freeze it. They were out of almond tortillas, in case you were planning on going. And I was thinking about, you know, what I wanted to talk about. The more I started wanting to talk, you know, trying to synthesize everything that matters to me about this stuff, because I don't, you know, I've lived in environments where I got to give a talk 2-3 times a week. So if I get to give a talk, you know, a couple times a year, it's like, geez, this is my time to shine. What am I gonna put together? That's the most important stuff about this to me, you know? And the more I thought about encapsulating Buddhism, the more stressed I got. And I'm like, okay, well, let me just talk about myself, you know, talk about it from kind of the first person. And then we have this tradition in the San Francisco Zen Center of when someone's kind of, when people are gathering together for practice period, or if someone is serving as head student, they'll give what we call a way-seeking mind talk, which is kind of the story of how you arrived at practice. So I'm going to do like a 1/3 way-seeking mind talk. Let's see. But first, I would like us to chant together. I think it'll help me. Maybe it'll help you. I had time for coffee, but I didn't have time for food. Are you familiar with that feeling?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like you're stone, but you're full of electricity. So there's when I lived at a Tibetan center, we did this, the Shakyamuni Buddha mantra. And it goes, Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Munaye Soha. Tayata means like, here it comes, or here we go, this is it, thus, you know. And then Om is the primordial sound of the universe. And then Muni means like sage. then maha means great. So it's like sage, sage, great sage. Mm. And then soha means like amen. Or one of my teachers, Michael Wanger, said soha means wow. Or hallelujah. It's a right on, you know. And soha, sometimes in Sanskrit, you'll hear swaha. Or in Japanese, you'll hear soaka. So I'm going to do it once with the melody. Maybe you can join me. And then when I start to drag out the syllables really long, that'll be the last one. You know that method, the dragging it out so you know it's the end? Daya ta om lani lani maha munaye soha. Daya ta om lani lani maha munaye that's what I always wanted religion to be. That feeling. And that's what I'm going to hope to talk about. Oh, do I get to have a little clock?
I think there's one behind you.
Really? That's convenient. Oh, there's a bell too. I could have used the bell instead of the slowdown. All right. When do I stop?
10:22. Do you want me to give you a warning signal?
If I don't stop, you can.
Well, also there'll be a signal because the kids will come on screen and then.
Oh, do I have to entertain them?
No, that's for the precept ceremony.
Oh, for the precept ceremony. Okay, great. It's not like at Green Gulch, we used to do this thing where it was a kids program. The first half of the talk was like for the kids. Mm-hmm. I never got that day. I feel like kids can see right through you. Like whenever I'm in front of a kid, I'm like, oh, they know I'm terrible. I can trick grown-ups, but kids know. So my family came to this country in 1920 on a boat called the Belvedere. Named after 1980s television butler, Mr. Belvedere. And they, when you go through Ellis Island, there's all these little podiums. Has anyone ever been? Yeah. There's all these little podiums and they're like, are you a communist? Are you polygamist? Are you an anarchist? You know? And then you go, there's two tunnels after the podiums. One takes you to New Jersey and one takes you to, I think, like Battery Park. Mm-hmm. And my family went to New Jersey, and you go to a train station in New Jersey, and they took a train across the country and landed in Pittsburgh, Antioch, Martinez area, which is north of San Francisco, kind of northeast of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And according to legend, my great-grandpa, Giuseppe, regretted coming. And the story goes, when it was recited to me, he's like, at home, and he was from Palermo. He's like, at home, I had my own taxi company, which was horse-drawn. He's like, I have my own taxi company, but me, I'm here, and I just push a broom. But then sardines took off in Monterey. And so all the Italians from, a lot of the Italians from San Francisco went to Monterey and worked in the sardine fishing. So I have pictures of my great-grandmother with a little bonnet on, canning sardines. It's like, if you ever get a chance to, if sardine canning is as interesting to you as it is to me, there's a Marilyn Monroe movie called Flash by Night, and it's all filmed in Cannery Row. It shows the actual fish hoppers. It's really interesting. There's vacuums under the water and it shoot the fish into the canneries. Anyway, so I grew up Catholic. I went to Catholic school. And right around the time I was born, my dad got a job in this little town, population 7,000, called King City. And if you've ever driven from on the 101 from like LA to San Francisco, that's where everybody gets speeding tickets, is King City. And I got into the life in King City was very different from the life in Monterey. If I would have grown up in Monterey, I probably would have had slick back hair and maybe some, like a gold crucifix with a little horn. And I maybe would have become a mechanic or a fisherman or something like that. Then King City was all agriculture and livestock and stuff like that. So we got into that. And I remember going around doing a high school rodeo and stuff. And I was on the cover of the King City Wrestler twice, both times with pigs. One time was with pigs my dad shot, and the second time was with a championship hog in 4-H. I better cut to the chase. But then I decided I wanted to be, Point Break came out, and I decided I didn't want to be a cowboy. I said I don't want to be a skateboarder and a surfer, and I want to listen to punk rock. And I started playing music, and then eventually I moved to San Francisco, and I was in a punk band in San Francisco. And then when you're in a punk band in San Francisco, you get to meet anarchists, and you get to meet vegans, and you get to meet people working with food, not bombs, and stuff like that. And you know, your band gets asked to play like the Zapatista benefit, and you're like, "What's a Zapatista?" And then you learn about politics through punk rock in San Francisco, especially at that time, before the internet. Before the internet was what it is. And then living there, I got really interested in the history of San Francisco counterculture and the Black Panthers and the hippies and the beatniks and stuff like that. And then when you get into the beatniks, then you learn about Buddhism. You learn about Buddhism wrong, but you learn that it exists, you know? So I thought Jack Kerouac was like the coolest thing in the world until I learned what misogyny was. But, so I got really interested in Buddhism, and then I'm right there in San Francisco. And so I go to San Francisco Zen Center. And also there was a punk band in the early 90s called Shelter. And they were, and this was a thing in punk rock in the early 90s. They were Hare Krishna devotees. And so there are a handful of like really bands that played really heavy music. There's one called 108. There's one called Shelter. Those were the two big ones. They were kind of good cop, bad cop. And they had songs about like, you know, my one concern is to manifest devotion and stuff like that. And I remember seeing all their cover art was Hindu deities. And they had a song that goes, mantra, take me home, I trust you. I remember in the album liner notes, there is one of the guys named John Porcelli, and he had all the Tulasi beads, the holy wood beads all around his neck, real kind of tight, they wore. And his head shaved except for a little bit in the back. and he's reading the Bhagavad Gita, and he's in this like dingy subterranean kind of staircase, like probably like in the Bowery or something like that in New York. And I remember seeing him and just being like, I want to do that. You know, I want my life to be about something old and sacred, you know. And I still have the sense of sacred. And I liked having the sense of sacred, and I liked having the sense of devotion. You know, that devotion was part of religion, or that sense of the divinity or sacredness was a part of devotion. And one time a Jehovah's Witness came to my house in Monterey and gave me a little book, said, all scripture comes from God or something like that. And it was a little book that went through every religion to kind of slander them. You know, very politely. And there is, but even in the Hindu section, there was a picture of an om. And it said, you know, kind of like mockingly, like the om is a symbol of impersonal divinity. You know, and I'm like, I'm in. So I took my little Jehovah's Witness om book and I went to the tattoo guy in Santa Cruz. And I'm like, give me that. And I still have it. It's fading a little bit. It's supposed to be the first of many, but once you grow up, you're like, well, no, that's, I've never had the money where I felt like, what am I going to do with this $500? You know, I'll put it inside of me, for eternity, never to be retrieved. So then I get interested in Zen. You know, and I got the Zen that was served up by the kind of hubris of that generation that was interpreting it for me. You know, the American, you know, your Alan Watts Alan Watts and Gary Snyder. So I ended up at San Francisco Zen Center and I got Zazen instruction. It was May 25th, 2002. Before I went to San, but I was kind of courting Buddhism for a while. I saw Thich Nhat Hanh live. My mom actually, right after he died, my mom sent me a picture of the program. My mom still had the program, and that was September 19th, 2002. Oh, so that was after I went to City Center for the first time. Anyway. And when I go there, I see a priest named Michael Winger, and he's got the samoe, the kind of wraparound top in the pants. I don't see any here right now. Good, Daishin's one. The top that goes over left to right, and then the kind of baggy trousers. And he was sitting there, and he had beads in his hand. He had Parkinson's, so his hand kind of shook a little bit. And he got out of his chair, he turned around, and he walked out of the room. And when I watched him do that, I said, that person has no agenda. You know, there was a way of his movement, you know, where I was just like, because, you know, I'm 19 or 20 at the time. And my whole life was, I was marketing my personality. You know, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to present to people for their approval and appreciation. You know, that was all. I mean, I'm still in recovery. I'm still a little bit doomed, you know. So I see Michael Winger walk out of the room. And you know, I like sometimes when I retell stories, as long as it's not incriminating or unfair or something like that, I say people's names because this is going to get recorded. Someday someone may listen to this and it puts the pieces together. I think if I'm vague, I saw a priest, you know, it's like, no, it was Michael Winger, you know, that, it matters. And so I'm like, I'll do this. So I'm like, how do you become this? You know? And they're like, well, you got to live here. really. I mean, back then that was kind of the answer. I mean, more or less, you kind of got to live here, especially if San Francisco's not center. It's a place that's focused on residency, you know. So I go to Tassajara, which is the mountain retreat center, and I moved there. My parents drove me in. That was 2003. I was 21 years old. And I stayed till my 30th birthday, more or less, in that system. You know, I go to Tassajara. I like went to Green Gulch a little bit, City Center a little bit. I got ordained when I was about 25 or 26. Tassajara is pretty, in one sense, kind of gnarly, and in one sense, kind of easy. You know, you wake up, you live in the, and back then there was no internet and there was mostly no electricity. We had little kerosene lanterns in our rooms. If you had a room with a heater, then it might be in the 50s, temperature wise, you know, but otherwise your toilet could freeze over at night, you know? And we go, so wake up bells at 3:50. And then on a regular day, you're sitting six periods of zazen. On a session day, you'd sit about 10. And every meal is orioki, except for on your day off. On your day off, you get to get up at 4:50. And you only sit morning and evening. Yeah. And then you're off in the middle of the day. And then, but then you got to do laundry and you got to replace the little cotton tip on the cleaning stick for your bowls. So it's like not a lot of downtime, really. Little did I know that was perfect for me, because I have, the way that my brain works, I need a lot of scaffolding in order to accomplish anything, you know. But you know, so the lore, when do I have to stop?
In about 20 minutes.
Okay, we'll see. No, we'll see. Like, I'm not gonna like just ignore that, but anyway. Okay. So there was this kind of Zen revival in the early 20th century, late 19th century in Japan. And in our sect, the Soto sect, that kind of went in two directions. There was a direction that was kind of steered by this figure named Daiyun Sogaku Harada. And Daiyun Sogaku Harada was the teacher of Hakuun Yasutani, who was in turn the teacher of a lot of important figures. The two of them together are responsible for the lineage of Taizan Maezumi Roshi, Philip Kaplow, Robert Aitken, you know. So a lot of the people that brought, that imported meditation-oriented, you know, Zen to this continent were students of that lineage. And that lineage revitalized Soto Zen by bringing in elements of Rinzai-style koan training. So a lot of the lineages of Soto Zen in the U.S. are this kind of blend of Rinzai-style koan training and the koan curriculum with Soto Zen, with kind of like with a Soto Zen ritual life and reverence for Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen. Then there was another movement that was a little bit older, that was started by figures like Nishi Aribokusan, Kishizawa Ion, Eiko Hashimoto, and Soaki Koro. Eiko Hashimoto was one of Daimin Katagiri's teacher. And that is a little bit more orthodox for the time style of Soto Zen, with an emphasis solely on Dogen and not a strong emphasis on like kind of koan introspection training, where you have this kind of emphasis on like a breakthrough experience or a kensho experience of, where like where there is an experience, a specific experience where you see your true nature. That's not so much a part of the strain of Zen that was taught by Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi, by according to my understanding. That the non-breakthrough enlightenment experience koan style Zen that we are kind of doing in this style is that, you know, you'll hear that emphasis on shikantaza, or just sitting. Shikantaza is a little bit of a pun. In vernacular Japanese before Dogen, shikan was the way that you would pronounce Shamatha Vipassana. She means stopping time and seeing. But Dogen kind of took Shikan and changed the characters, but the pronunciation's the same, which is a fun, clever thing you can do in Japanese literature. So you're saying Shikan Ta is nothing but hitting sit. Ta is kind of like an exponent. Nothing but hitting the mark of sit. And it's this radically, you know, if you've ever come across the writings of like Kodo Sawaki, it's this radically unambitious, uncalculated sitting of just throwing yourself into the activity of being here with no agenda being here. And when you're throwing yourself into the activity of being here with no agenda, you are touching the reality of existence. And that was really appealing to me, especially since the thing that was most impressive to me was Michael Wanger walking out of the room with no agenda. I wanted to relinquish my project of being impressive, you know? But I go to the monastery and I do everything they tell me to do to the best of my ability. And it was never quite good enough. I don't know about their perception of me, but for me, I felt like there was this thing that was on offer. And it was like, do this and, you know, yeah, we got no goal. But I mean, there's peace. Peace is available if you do this, you know. And I'm like, I don't have that, you know, this experience. And then, you know, we're chanting these chants where there's this, you know, at noon we chant self-receiving and employing samadhi. Samadhi means like absorption, you know? And then in the morning, we sing the song of the jewel mirror samadhi. I'm like, samadhi? And they're like, yeah, you know, when you sit and like, you're just absorbed in sitting and body and mind are unified. Like, no. And they're like, well, you know, keep at it. It takes time. And I'm just kind of like, it's been 10 years. You know, and like not even a little bit, not even, you know, like, well, you know how like, you know, the thoughts arise, but then you return to your posture and then the space between the thoughts gets bigger. And I'm like, no. And I kind of thought everybody was lying to me or everybody was kind of faking it or something like that, you know. Very recently, I learned that about neurodivergence. You know, and there's, and it's not, might not be a matter of willpower. It might be a matter of wiring that I'm constantly thinking about stuff, you know? Now, as I said earlier, the scaffolding of monastic practice helped me to actually stay on the cushion. And there were benefits for that, that I experienced for myself. Even if the only benefit was patience with what was arising. You know, but the shadow side of it was like, and I feel like, you know, it's unfortunate. I feel like the first few years of my practice, the word delusion was used a lot in the teaching that I received and the way that I related to my experience, you know, and when you're new, depending on who's interpreting Buddhism for you, the word delusion can play a big role. For some of us, maybe most of us, maybe all of us, I don't know how beneficial it is, you know? And the presentation of it for me was like, well, delusion is when you're thinking. And I'm like, well, shit. You know? So I'm being patient with the thoughts that arise and they're all wrong. And I still have a life to live. So my life is disregarding everything that arises, you know, and it's just like, where does that leave you? You know? And one thing I did notice was that my favorite part of the day was service. My favorite part of the day was the morning ceremony, and we did it good there. Oh, that made it sound like as opposed to other places. But I mean, you know, when you got 60 people living it 24/7 for 3 months, they get good. Yeah. you know, there's a harmony there. You know, you get the orioki, the way you use your bowls gets really elegant when you have to do it to eat. It's not a ceremony you do like a couple times a year or something like that, you know. And my teacher in particular is a gay Episcopal priest. So it was his, he really had, is that appropriate to say? But his taste was just impeccable, you know, and the way he conducted the ceremonies was just like, you know, he had an eye for it that some of the other men priests didn't have so much. I remember he used to look at my collars. He'd be like, "Do you need a mirror?" Quarter inch of white, quarter inch of gray, quarter inch of black, you know? And then with the skirt, the bottom of the skirt, 4 fingers of gray, 4 fingers of black robe, 4 fingers of ocasa, you know, with the hems, the way the hems fall at the bottom. The flap that goes over the shoulder. I wanted a 90-degree angle and the horizontal, you know, everything is very, you know, and that was, there was a lot more emphasis on that than there was on what to do when you're sitting on the cushion, which is fine for me because the cushion thing was kind of a mess for me anyway. You know? But my favorite thing that I got to do was when I got to be we called it Kokyo. Kokyo means announcing the chant. Kyo means like sutra, announcing the chants. And you got to recite the echo. The echo is the dedication of merit that would happen in between the sutras that you chant. So everyone would begin, "May our intention equally extend to every being in place," or "May we awaken Buddha's compassion and luminous mirror wisdom." Or sometimes for special ceremonies, you get to do it in Japanese. And there's a style of chanting called shomyo in Japanese that's supposed to really be emotionally evocative and actually bring the mind into samadhi when it's done correctly. And I remember doing the dedication for the Suzuki Roshi's memorial in Japanese, chant the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and equality in Japanese, then do the echo in Japanese. And there's this moment where you go up and you say the name of the person that you're dedicating the chant to. You go, "Doji Kaisan Shogaku Shinryu Daiyo Shogaki no Shinyo." And I would get the chills and I would feel like we were talking like that was, there was something holy happening, you know? And it wasn't about watch your mind and overcome your delusion, you know? And so I got really interested in that aspect of practice, which I think in the Western context is not the aspect of practice that I was supposed to like the most. The aspect of practice that I was supposed to like the most was kind of the rational aspect of practice. Yeah. But, you know, when you go to a Soto Zen temple, not a Zen center, but a Soto Zen temple, the practices that are happening are sutra copying, hymn singing, you know, memorial services. Things that bring your heart mind into a kind of settled and sacred feeling. So I started trying to figure out how to, within the Soto Zen context, explore the part of me that was moved so much by that. And I encountered some writings of Dogen that felt like they corroborated that. And then some writings of a contemporary of Dogen named Shinran Shonin, who is the founder of the Jodo Shinshu. Jodo Shinshu means like true Pure Land school. You know, the Heian period in Japan was a period of really intense, like, famine and civil war. This is the late 1100s. Right around that time, the beginning of Kamakura period, so this is like 1180 to 1250, all of these new that's not the whole Common Core period, but that specific few decades, would, out of, you know, a bunch of stability and consistency around the Buddhist schools in Japan, all of a sudden you got like 5 new Buddhist schools, like in like one generation. And it happened right on the tail end of this period of intense difficulty, economic difficulty and famine and warfare in Japan, the Heian period. And all of those schools have something in common. Sometimes they call them the Kamakura schools. All of those schools were all former monks of the Tendaishu, which a Tendaishu is very kind of syncretic, lots of different practices, lots of study and ritual. All of those picked one thing to focus on and just like put all your eggs in this basket. So you had Eisai, put all your eggs in koan study. You had Dogen, put all your eggs in Shikantaza. You had Honen, put all your eggs in reciting Buddha's name. You had Nichiren, put all your eggs in reciting the title of the Lotus Sutra. You know, and I heard I was watching a video about Nichiren, and he said he took on every sect that didn't rhyme with Nichiren. Which is, because Nichiren was big on everything else is the devil, you know. But what would it, you know, why would that be that when the shit's really hitting the fan, to just be like, just rely on this one thing, you know? And from Shinran's point of view, the idea of just like relying on this one thing is so that you can develop he called it Shinjin, which is the mind of entrusting, the mind of true entrusting. And so Shinran's method of practice was just reciting Buddha's name. And this is what he had to say about it. If it is understood that the person of Shinjin, so the person of true entrusting, if it is understood that the person of Shinjin dwells in the stage of the truly settled, there is no calculation on the part of the practitioner. Hence, we speak of other power, as opposed to self-power. The other power being that which leads you to liberation, rather than your own self-effort. Hence, we speak of other power in which no working is true working. Since practitioners have become free of calculation as to whether they are good or evil, pure or defiled, it is said that no working is true working, because persons of Shinjin dwell in the same stage as the future Buddha, who will attain Buddhahood after one lifetime. It is certain that they are grasped, never to be abandoned. Hence, what we call other power means that there is no room for the slightest particle of calculation on the part of the practitioner. For this reason, it is said that no working is true working. Master Honen said, beyond this, nothing needs to be said. Simply entrust yourself to the Buddha. Which sounds to a mind that formulated in an Abrahamic culture. It's like, that sounds familiar. You know? But when we're talking about Buddha, you know, what is the mind of Buddha? And you can trace the thread through Buddhist history. Okay, my body and mind is a composition of different elements that are temporarily together, and there's no inherent selfhood from its own side. Okay. And you fast forward another 500 years, all phenomena is temporarily strewn together by elements other than themselves. And they do not have an inherent existence from its own mind. And existence pivots on an empty space. And there has to be an empty space for existence to pivot upon, or else nothing can be dynamic. So what's happening all around us is what Dogen calls Zen Ki, which is Zen means total or complete, and Ki means the mechanics of something, how something works. Zen Ki means the dynamic function, the complete dynamic function. So we can say in Buddhism, there isn't a creator. You know, but there is a total dynamic function. Dogen used to say, I forget, but it was like, he would say all the things that existed at different seasons. Do you cuckoos in the summertime or something like that, maple in the fall. You know, there's a dynamic function. We're not falling through the ground right now. You know, leaves taking carbon dioxide and give you a return oxygen. You know, the snow's going to melt. You know, the little buds are going to appear after the snow melts. So, this is from, I think, Shobo Genzo Imu, which is a text by Dogen. Zen Master Daikan of Soke-san Mountain, in one occasion, teaches Zen Master Dae of Nangaku, this is something coming like this. These words say that being like this is beyond doubt, for it is beyond understanding. Because this is something, we should realize and experience that all the myriad things are truly something. We should realize and experience that every single thing is truly something. Something not open to doubt. It comes like this. So there's a way to read the traditional teachings of non-self or emptiness and be like, and it was done, you know, in especially early translations, by the hubris of early Western translators that weren't doing their due diligence to actually learn what Buddhism was. You know, like emptiness, the void, you know. But it's just the emptiness that is the space in which there can be a pivot for the dynamism of existence. Otherwise, it's all welded together. You know, there has to be an empty, there has to be bearings in there for the world to happen, you know, and that world is inmo, suchness, unfathomable, beyond our control, you know, and the selfhood is a layer of adventitious, unnecessary conceptualization, unnecessary calculation that we're laying on top of it. You know. So rather than, you know, our style of practice, I would say, is rather than me minus my delusion is awakened. It's like the real me plus nothing is awakened. So our practice is doing the plus nothing, which is just another angle on the minus delusion, you know. And so you can do that by practicing Zazen, and you could do that by relinquishing ambition by chanting Buddha's name. You could do that by saying, may we awaken Buddha's compassion and luminous mirror of wisdom. Yeah. You can do that by saying, may my intention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. You can do that by saying, Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Munaye Soha. Yeah. Just like taking time when you remember to be like, I don't know, but I'm here for it. Yeah. I think that's as far as sound bites are useful. So to Zen, I don't know, but I'm here for it. You know. So if you are practicing meditation in a way that feels like it's not giving you that feeling of settledness. And I don't mean settled like peaceful mind or quiet mind, but just like I'm here and it's okay. you know, play with it and figure out, you know, maybe you need a little bit of God, you know, and maybe you need a lot of God, you know, and it doesn't matter what your concepts around that is, you know, but if it's, you know, it's kind of like when you're thirsty, the most important thing is water, and the love of your life, or, you know, a free home. If you had a choice between water and the free home, or the water and the love, you need the water, you know? So any idea about transcending your limited views and the, you know, liberation or whatever like that, actually, if you're unsettled, none of that matters. You know, so first things first, you know, situating your heart mind so that you can feel like you actually live here in this existence, you know, and it is my time.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I love Q&A. I'm great at Q&A. And I didn't leave any time for Q&A, but feel free to talk to me anytime. Thank you so much.